Let me try something for a minute. I want you to imagine that you are sitting in the office of a coworker early one morning. This colleague is also a dear friend who's been feeling poorly for weeks and has just come back to work after several days of diagnostic tests in the hospital. The friend reports that the preliminary diagnosis points to a malignancy. And the words scare and startle you in your hearing as much as they seem to unnerve the one who speaks them. And your friend, obviously stunned and fearful, turns to you and says, "I need you to pray for me. Could you pray with me now?" Now, for some of you, the next step is down a well-worn path over which years of prayers have been said. For others, the next step is more difficult, for though you have prayed in the past, most of the prayers have been written in church bulletins or memorized for a table grace or have been used in a child's good night. And for still others of you, what the friend has asked is deeply unsettling, leaving you with a host of questions. Of course you will pray, but where does one begin? What are the words to speak? What's the proper posture? And if one's words and prayers aren't heard, much less answered, what then? Not infrequently, people have asked me such questions, asking help with prayer. Several have done so recently. And often I respond by saying that prayer, straightforwardly described, is simply conversation with God, honest and open, whether the mood is exuberant or desperate, whether the feeling one has is joy or fear or even anger. Look to the Psalms, I say, like the psalm that Meg read for us today, and listen to the sometimes anguished and sometimes bewildered, sometimes effervescent prayers of the psalmist. The prayers you whisper across the years and circumstances of your life will run the gamut of such moods and emotions. Considering the Psalms and looking closely at the passage from Luke's Gospel today, I find several important hints about prayer that are particularly helpful to me, at least. First, prayer is a discipline. Like other disciplines, it takes practice for it to become substantive in our lives. That's not to say that there are no spontaneous prayers, no outbursts of praise or thanksgiving or petition, but as Luke understands Jesus' teaching on prayer, true prayer is a learned experience and not simply the release of the heart's natural longings. And so Jesus gives his disciples even the words to use when they pray. Now Luke remembers those words a bit differently than Matthew does in his longer and more familiar form and the one that we pray most often. Luke remembers Jesus employing fewer words, a couple of brief ascriptions of praise to God, and three petitions for those who are praying. Interestingly, in Luke's remembrance, the petitioner asks God to forgive sins rather than debts. But in terms of forgiving others, it is for their debts, perhaps reflecting Luke's clear concern that possessions not hinder the experience of community. The thrust of the prayer is the same as in Matthew. A friend says there's something comforting in this picture of Jesus giving his disciples the words to use. For one thing, it prompts in us a recognition that prayer is not a casual thing. We don't swagger down the aisle, plop down in the second pew in God's presence. When we talk to God, it may be good to remember that we don't know how to talk to God, because God is so far beyond us. But Jesus gives us the very words, the language, which becomes our bridge. "When you pray," he said, "say this." Discipline is implicit, but first, it is a gift. And the gift of the words to say is such a gift, formative for the discipline itself. There's no telling how many persons have mouthed the words of the Lord's Prayer in surgical waiting rooms or in airplanes or after a family crisis or even in a moment of profound gratitude. Words to speak when we can find no words ourselves, words that form a resounding chorus of praise and petition, words that express a longing beyond the world we experience for the world God intends, for the kingdom of God to come on earth as it is in heaven. First hint here is that prayer is a practiced discipline. The second is linked to that discipline. It is important to be persistent in prayer, Luke says. Be persistent. Frederick Buechner says, according to Jesus, by far the most important thing about praying is to keep at it. The images he uses to explain this are all rather comical, as though he thought it was rather comical to have to explain it at all. He says, God is like your friend that you go to borrow bread from at midnight. The friend tells you, in effect, to drop dead, but you keep on knocking anyway until he finally gives you what you want so that he can go back to sleep again. Or God is like a crooked judge who refuses to hear the case of a certain poor widow, presumably because he knows there's nothing much in it for him. But she keeps on hounding him until he finally hears her case just to get her out of his hair. Even a harsh person, Jesus says, won't give his own child a black eye when he asks for peanut butter and jelly. So how all the more will God do when God's children ask God? Be importunate, Jesus says, not one assumes because you have to beat a path to God's door before God will open it, but because until you beat the path, maybe there's no way of getting to your door. Be persistent in prayer, knowing that your prayers will be heard, that God's kingdom will come and God's will be done, that justice and mercy will finally triumph in the end, even if in the moment our prayers seem to fall on deaf ears. Most of us are prone to see all the tragedies of life all around us and simply adjust to them rather than allow ourselves to hope that the world might be transformed. Earnest prayer begins in the trust that God will make all things right, will do so. And that confidence is the fuel that enables us to keep at our prayers. My friend Tom R. is pastor of a church in Kansas City. He and I worked together for a season of our lives as colleagues, pushing and prodding each other in matters of faith and life. And I've long known of Tom's great love for his younger brother, Gene, who was born with cognitive deficits. As Tom says, he was born with a generous heart, but a limited mind. Speaking of Gene, one day Tom said, Gene will never forget my birthday, but he will never remember how to spell his own name. Gene has almost never called me by name. I'm brother. He in his 50s now, but he couldn't pass the first grade. If I prayed shamelessly in my life, Tom says, it has been about Gene. For as Frank Craddock would say, I've stood at the door with bloody knuckles waiting for the good things. Gene wants to drive a car. That's his goal in life, and usually it's a red car, sometimes a convertible. He wants to get his license and stop by the gas station to fill her up, as he says, and buy a Coke with his own money and drive his car. And Tom remembered a recurring conversation with his brother. Gene, where do you want to go? I'll ask. And he'll say, I'm going to come see you. That'd be great, Gene. Then I'll take you and we'll go see Daddy. Don't tell him I'm coming. Tom said, it's our secret, Gene. But then one day, while visiting Gene near his group home in Louisiana, Tom said, we sat across from each other at Shoney's. Gene had finished his usual litany regarding the car, and then in a moment so unlike him that it almost seemed surreal, he asked, "Do you think I'll ever drive a red car, brother?" And I said, "Yes. It won't be soon, I reckon, but someday you will drive." And then Tom said, "Of course, he never will drive. Certainly not my car," he said, "but it's not about driving, not even for Gene. It's about everything that's gone wrong being set right. I should have said, someday you'll be able to connect with your brother and intelligence won't be a barrier. Someday you'll be able to give the gift of your presence to your father. Somewhere at the foundation of the gospel," Tom said, "is the promise that God will make life right. The kingdom will come. Hatred and bigotry and racism and prejudice will be swallowed up by people committed to living with rather than against each other. Our leaders will rediscover the notion of the common good. The hunger of children will give way to the noise of table blessings. The work of violence will cease. And all God's children will someday grow up to be neither the haters nor the hated. That day hasn't come yet, but we know it will come. It will come. And it belongs to God. And today, by the Spirit of God, we ask, seek, knock on the door of that holy time. If we could, we would give that gift to each other, wouldn't we? How much more will God?" Hint two, then. Be persistent in your prayer, trusting in the ultimate grace and providence and goodness of God. Know that your prayers will be heard. And that third and final hint Luke offers is that God does answer prayer, though not always affirmatively, nor even at times with what we ask. Expect God to answer, but not necessarily in the way you expect, Kathleen Norris says. Sometimes people will say things like, "Your prayers didn't work, but thanks anyway," as if a person could be praying only for one thing, a miracle, a cure. But in the hardest situations, all one can do is ask for God's mercy. "Let my friend die at home, Lord, and not in the hospital. Let her go quickly, God, and with her loved one's presence." One friend, a gentle, thoughtful man who has been in constant physical pain for years and is now confined to a wheelchair, says of prayer, "Often all I can do is ask God, Lord, what is it you want of me?" From him, I've learned that prayer is not asking for what you think you want, but asking to be changed in ways you can't imagine, to be made more grateful, more able to see the good in what you have been given instead of always grieving for what might have been. People who are in the habit of praying know that when a prayer is answered, it's almost never in the way they expect. So back to that office and your friend. "I need you to pray for me," says this one so dear to you. And of course you'll pray, but you know the risks inherent in doing so. Beyond finding the right words, beyond your feelings of dis-ease and vulnerability, the seemingly greatest risk is that your colleague's disease may actually spread, and that despite your prayers, your friend may die. And with that death, you may sense that you have failed in prayer or that God has failed you. It may be easier not to pray than to take such a risk. To such a fear, Luke's gospel answers loud and clear. Keep praying. Keep praying. Even when your prayers are dry as the dust, keep praying. Just keep praying, Jesus says. Remember the sleepy friend. Remember the crooked judge. Even if your friend dies, keep on beating the path to God's door, because the one thing you can be sure of is that down the path you beat with even your most half-cocked and halting prayer, the God you call on will finally come. And even if God does not bring you the answer you want, God will bring himself. And maybe at the secret heart of all our prayers, that is what we're really praying for.